And welcome to the podcast, everybody. We interviewed Anthony Kim, CEO of Education Elements, on episode 3 of I Teach Live on March 26th, 2018. The following is that interview in its entirety.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear us?
Hey, Anthony. Yeah, I could barely hear you guys for some reason.
Oh, no. Can you hear us now? Better?
Yeah, now it's better, yeah.
All right, we turn up the mic.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Well, good morning, Anthony.
Oh.
Hey.
Thank you.
I wasn't sure if you guys, what was going on, if you guys were live at 10 or live at 10:15, so.
Yeah, well, we are live.
I didn't want to say anything right away.
No, yeah, we are live and we are ready for you. So thank you so much for calling in and bearing with our technical difficulties. We are not sound engineers by trade, as shocking as that is.
All right, make sure you don't press that button again.
Right.
terrible button.
He only has one eardrum left.
Right.
Yeah.
That might be why you're having difficulty hearing us. We can't even actually hear ourselves. So.
Oh, cool. That's always helpful.
Well, awesome. Thank you so much for calling in. So this is Stephanie, and then you've also got Anissa and Andy.
Hello, Anthony.
What's up?
What time is it where you're calling from? Are you on East Coast right now?
No, I'm in San Francisco. It's like 7.
Okay, yeah.
Right early. That's
a real commitment, and I applaud you, sir. Because at 7 o'clock this morning, I was still drooling on my pillow.
So let's introduce our yes. listeners to Anthony and his work.
Yeah. So Anthony is a really awesome human and somebody that I've admired for a while. And Anthony, I'll let you talk a little bit about your, you know, short history / long history with not only Ed Elements, but really in the entire sphere of educational influence. But I just want to call out for everyone that Anthony's one of those people that if you don't already follow, you need to follow. His team at Ed Elements is just one of the most devoted teams I think that I've found in the field, and people that are really qualifying and quantifying the great work that's happening in schools. So, Anthony, do you want to give us sort of the 2-minute history of you in a nutshell?
Yeah. So, I got involved in education back in 2000. Probably one of the first things we had thought about was web analytics for LMSs. And through that, I got to learn quite a bit about higher education and online and digital K-12 education, and decided to focus most of my attention in 2003 in education and K-12 education, and ended up building all sorts of different products for different schools, like SIS and assessments, and I eventually got into curriculum, eventually moved into online schools, and I ended up selling that company to Edison Schools in 2008. By 2010, I left and worked with Michael Horn on a project where we were able to redesign an elementary school in South Central Los Angeles with what's now known as the station rotation model. And while we were doing that, we had the opportunity to, Michael and I also produced a thing called the EdTech Market Map back then, which was funded by a foundation for us to kind of organize all EdTech companies into different categories and kind of map them out as to where they would be most appropriate for use. And so through that process, we just learned so much about technologies and implementations. I also was doing another project for a company to evaluate every ELA product that was digital, and we learned a lot around like the quality of implementation varied so much. And so when I started Education Elements, we really focused on helping districts implement technology and new instructional models better. In the early days, it was really just focused on digital content, but now we've expanded into strategic planning and competency-based education, personalized learning, organizational design. Like, we've expanded the types of service we offer because we realized that schools struggle with getting a lot of the project management pieces done while they're making, you know, their best efforts to implement things that will hopefully close that achievement gap we're all looking to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I should be transparent that the first opportunity that I had to work with you and your team was when I was sitting in the district office here in Fulton County in Georgia. And it was through the support of Ed Elements that we were able to really start the redesign process across 100 plus schools, which, again, to your point, in any size district is really a difficult task when you have already staffed the positions for other things. Like, there is no staff position for redesign. There is no internal admin position at a school for redesign. And so it's really difficult to find the capacity in existing organizations. And so we've just been fast friends since. And I love everybody on your team. And I just think that they're some of the greatest folks out there. And so so I really thought it was great when I saw this new book come out, because it really spoke a lot to that sort of organizational piece. You know, and through the white paper that we've worked on here in the state of Georgia, it's really about those systems and those organizations that are either prohibitive or supportive of personalized learning that many times make or break the implementation of whatever teachers at the classroom level are trying to do. So I'd love to just kind of dive right in with some of the questions. And if, for those of you who are listening, if you've not already checked out, we've been tweeting, but definitely check out on a million different places, but probably for most people, Amazon's the fastest way to get to it, to check out New School Rules. And Anthony, who remind me who your co-author was on this book?
Yeah, I mean, just to give you a little bit of background on her and why we decided to work together on this, she, Alexis Gonzalez Black, she was a former TFA person, ended up working at Zappos, and when the CEO decided to make the shift towards more kind of self-organized management styles, she led that project. And then when she left Zappos, she started a consulting firm for a little bit before she went to work at IDEO as an org designer there, which is where she's at now. And so we met through that process, and with anything that, whether, you know, it has to do with the workshops we deliver at school districts or this book, one of the things I really believe in this. I have to try some of this stuff on our own and on my own and learn from those experiences. So she helped us implement some of these practices that we write about in the book, even at our offices and at Elements. And we've tested some of these things out at some of the schools before we wrote the book.
Yeah, I think that's so, so important. And as a leader of a team, you know, I so appreciate that approach. I think it's really easy for us to just say, hey, this is a great idea. You should try this. But that's sort of what's wrong with organizations at large. I know, especially in school districts, it's frequently people who have been out of the classroom for a really long time trying to tell teachers what they should do inside of classrooms. So anytime we're thinking about like organizational shifts or whatever, I think it's awesome that you guys have done this work in the trenches of your own organization first and in a school before talking about what other people should do. So hats off for that.
So Anthony.
Yeah, thanks.
This is Anissa, and I'm curious as an educator. So when schools talk with you and Ed Elements, and I have to take you just a little bit to task, okay? You are not a certified teacher, right?
Right.
Right. So what perspective do you bring that adds value to the K-12 environment?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of kind of sayings we have in the book, and there's a few examples that I've used to deflect some of these ideas. So one is, you know, if we keep doing the same things over and over again, we're going to get the same results. And historically, we've seen people do the same things over and over again. And as a result, you can see over the last three decades, we've gotten very similar results. So one perspective might be, well, maybe someone that is thinking about teaching differently can provide different results. So that's one. Two, I think this notion that teaching kids is the same as teaching adults, I would challenge that a little bit, because, you know, the conditions that we're working in an adult work environment, which, as, you know, an entrepreneur and founder of multiple companies, like, I'm constantly trying to teach adults how to get certain things done around a particular vision. So I think that's very different than teaching somebody algebra or letter recognition.
Sure.
And then the third piece is, you know, and, you know, we joke about this in the office too. It's like, not the best coach. The best coaches aren't always the best players, and the best players don't make always the best coaches. And the same is true with, you know, Michelin star critics. Like, not all Michelin star critics are chefs.
Right. No, thank you. Thank you. When reading your book, so I read it a few weeks ago, I really enjoyed it. What would you hope is like the top two or three takeaways that you would want your readers to get in reading this? Especially if it was a school principal reading this book, what do you really hope that that they take away from this?
Yeah, so there's a story that isn't included in the book that isn't part of the presentations I have around the book, which has to do with so the way I explain it is I learned to swim 4 years ago, and when I was learning how to swim the first time, in order to get across the pool, I just expended a lot of energy. And by the time I got halfway to the pool, I was exhausted and couldn't get to the end, which was my goal. And my coach told me that I just needed to streamline my body better. And once I worked on that, I was able to get to the end of the pool multiple times, right? It's the same is true for teams and organizations where, if you consider like everybody on your team a cylinder in an engine that's working incredibly hard. However, if the shape of the team or the shape of the vessel is not worked on, then you're never going to reach all the goals that you want to reach. And so I think whether you're a school team trying to get all your teachers and APs who are all working incredibly hard to kind of be more streamlined and more efficient about getting stuff done, or you're a superintendent with, you know, 15,000 employees doing the same, we're all expending a lot of energy, but we're not reaching our goals. And I feel like the six practices within the book will help you shape that vessel so that you're more streamlined to getting things done. In our office, you know, we've implemented some of these things, and in the past, when we got through in a one-hour meeting with, you know, 10 people, if we could get through two agenda items, that was fantastic. Now we get through 10 to 15 agenda items in 1 hour.
Right. So just from a productivity perspective, I think that that's really interesting. I also want to just call out to our listeners that I have seen now in my progression from classroom teacher to district admin to working in higher ed and consulting and providing coaching and services, that many times people don't view school districts and schools as organizations, right? Mm. There's this disconnect between every other profession and education in the ways that we sort of view ourselves. And so we are organizations. Every school is an organization. Every district is an organization.
But we also know every organization's goal is to maintain.
That's right.
Right? So changing an organization, especially changing that organization from within, is a real challenge.
Yep.
So that's why we're talking today with Anthony Kim about the new school rules.
That's right.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So, Anthony, I found, this is Andy, by the way. Nice to speak with you this morning. We really appreciate your time again. I found interesting, you talked about planning for change instead of perfection in your book. And, you know, one of the things you talk about is how a lot of schools were ordering devices and they didn't really plan for, you know, the software to run on those devices. I've had a lot of experience with schools and districts rolling out and managing and trying to implement one-to-one devices. So, you know, some advice for school leaders. How do school leaders accurately plan for things like one-to-one initiatives or device rollouts and still allow for change and flexibility in there? What are some tips or some advice for those school leaders planning those things?
Yeah. Finally, we get to a question that I was given a heads up about. So I'm glad to have gotten this. So first of all, you have to realize you have to empathize on why people feel like they need to have these like multi-year plans, right? And part of it has to do with fear and uncertainty. And usually when you have those feelings, you want to control and you get more tight-fisted. So if you're rolling out some, you know, a $10 million, $100 million, $1 billion technology plan, you want to, because you get pressure from stakeholders, board members, the community, taxpayers, you're trying to show that you know what you're doing. And so this plan represents all of the actions I'm going to take. Unfortunately, especially nowadays, versus even 10 years ago, the predictability we have year over year is diminishing. You know, maybe a few years ago, even 10 years ago, we would say, well, I could predict maybe a year out what might happen. Now, you know, I feel fortunate if I could predict what can happen 6 months from now in terms of even our own organization. So, and we're certainly maybe the size of a school where a district is, you know, tens of thousands of employees. How do you predict where everyone's going to be, what they should be doing, what priorities come into place? You know, how many snow days you're going to have that might screw up your plan and your schedule. So there's a lot of factors, and so we expend tons of hours, months, years kind of developing this plan. And that's an example of wasted energy. And the way I would describe it is, just going back to some of the concepts that you guys have talked about earlier, you know, if you're a coach, you draw up a play, and, you know, I'm a fan of basketball, so you kind of come up with these plays, and that might take, a couple hours or a day or so. The team actually practices those plays over and over again for weeks until they get the play built into their muscle memory, where they don't have to think about the play. They know where their teammates are going to be. But you don't, when you execute the play, it only takes seconds. Like, it happens as a glimpse of a game. And so one of the things that I try to do when we thought about some of these practices is, you know, once I came up with these plays, we practiced in our office first, and then we practiced with some of the districts that we work with. And so I feel like our folks have a lot of fluency around this, and I could anticipate where they're going to be and what moves they're going to make. But then we have to contextualize it into, you know, something like this radio podcast, or something like a new client that we work with, where like it happens in real time. And that's kind of the mentality that we use in planning. Like, there's some kind of protocols and procedures that you're going to follow, and there's also a logic around where your teammates are going to be and what they're going to be working on, and there's a lot of trust around that. And then when you get to executing, it makes it so much easier.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought it was really profound when you mentioned that people overcommit to the plan so much that they can't see the goal anymore in the book. And that whole idea, again, how many times have we just sat around and participated in defining SMART goals and strategic plans? And then you can recite the language of the plan, but you can't then indicate what the goal is for the plan to begin with. You've lost sight of all of that. So I think that that's probably the biggest takeaway I took from the book, and just from talking about it, is we've got to stop doing that. We've got to break that cycle.
We need a level of flexibility in
and
our
districts.
Own action.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. And sometimes I think, you know, that your insights around the organizational planning piece in the book are really just spot on, in my opinion. And I think, again, in these traditional systems that we have, we're too committed to that plan to morph and adjust to meet goals that we might have that we didn't, again, have the foresight on, because we can't. It's a moving target. All of us are after moving targets. And so can you talk a little bit about what a very traditional organization, maybe one that's not even thinking about personalized learning, is not thinking about school redesign yet, but just somebody who maybe hears this and thinks, okay, well, maybe I can take a step towards a more iterative planning and design process. What's one first step that you might suggest for them?
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just working with a district a couple weeks ago in Pennsylvania and try to help them through something like this. And probably, I guess what I should mention is on our website, thenewschoolrules.com, there's a lot of things called workouts and experiments. So in our book, you'll notice that we had practices, six practices. There's 15 experiments that we list out there, and those are things that you could try right away. And then the workouts are things that are more like a sustained muscle memory building things that are on our website. But so one of the workouts that I did do with this district around this was helping them think through a particular reasonably large decision. And it's, in fact, like making clear what your decision is really important in this step. So a simple one would be, you know, one might say, well, my decision is to complete college in 4 years. I mean, and that's a goal that you're going to set for yourself. And there's all these other decisions you're going to make along with that. On the other hand, I could kind of tweak the goal as I'm going to prioritize going through college. That's the number one thing in my life for now. And those kind of the goals framed differently in those two ways makes a really big difference as to how you think about moving forward. Because when I say I'm going to complete college in 4 years, that might change my behaviors. It's just like I'm just going to coast through. I'm going to do it as fast as possible, regardless of all these other things that I might be interested in. So it changes kind of the dynamic. And if I don't complete it in 4 years, I feel like a complete failure because that was the goal I had. Mm-hmm. I could also say, you know, I'm going to prioritize this and I might complete it in 4 years. I might complete it in five. It could be longer, but I'm making decisions along the way. And in many ways, setting up your goals that way allow you to kind of continuously learn and evolve and also make decisions that might be different for you and right for you at that time. There's different outcomes and points of view on these. So you have to be absolutely, I'm not saying there's one that's better or the other. It's just how you set the goal determines all of the decisions that you need to make. And then we went through this process around, okay, let's list 10 decisions you have to make along those goals. You have to separate them out into kind of three categories. One is, the first one is, what do you absolutely know? So there are certain things that you will absolutely know, and usually out of 10, maybe one or two people really know. And you've all been in meetings where we're talking about hypotheticals, and so someone could just, like, pull us down a rabbit hole because they're saying, well, what if this happens? And no one ever asked, like, how often does that happen? Is that backed up with data? Is that just your opinion, or is it something that's been consistently happening? So we go through and go down this rabbit hole regardless. So being clear on what you know and what data you have and making decisions on those first is one step. The second category would be we believe something like that will happen, and it consistently does. So in the case with the district in Pennsylvania, they said, well, you know, we consistently get only 50% participation in our PDs. And so, okay, well, that's a fact. You know, I mean, there's some history around it. There's some data. So it just becomes a little bit more known than someone saying, well, what happens if only 50% comes in? That's just one person's opinion. And then finally, the last things you could table are the things that aren't backed with any sort of data. And usually what we found or what I found is either you ask the person who raises that to go get more data on this so that we can actually make an informed decision, or if you leave it on the agenda long enough, it just goes away because it becomes irrelevant.
Right, right. I think it's so funny. I mean, that's so foreign to many of the meetings that we sit in, like, where's the data? You just sort of take people at face value, and I think it would totally change a lot of conversations and a lot of the direction.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're listening to I Teach Live on KSU Owl Radio with Andy, Stephanie, and Anissa, and we're talking with Anthony Kim, author of The New School Rules. Anthony, we have a question for you, another one. You talk about building trust and allowing authority to spread in your new book. Can you offer us some strategies to move this idea forward in a building or a district that has a reluctant leader?
Yeah. You know, first of all, all of this stuff isn't these point solutions, right? It's a system of practice. And so there's a couple of things. One, you have to realize that habits are really hard to break. And so in order to break habits in people, you need certain things in place. One, there's kind of two things that I would say are most critical. One is you have to have a daily practice, something small enough where someone can try. So one thing that we do is for every meeting, there's what we call a check-in and check-out. And all that is no different than kids walking into your classroom and you saying hello to every kid and just getting a feel for where they're at. Same thing in meetings. We just usually walk in and we're all on our phones. We don't know why we're there. It's on our calendar. There's an agenda. And we just jump right into the meeting. And the same thing, we leave the meeting and go on to the next without like having a conversation with people. And so the way you kind of implement some of this stuff is around building that trust and that relationship and just saying hello to everybody and giving an opportunity for everyone to check in at the beginning of a meeting. It doesn't have to be long. We're not asking for even a minute. We're just asking for like 15 seconds each to say, I'm present. This is how I'm feeling right now. And it's incredible that when I start a meeting like that, it gives me so much data about how people might react to something. And it helps me understand, like, if I bring up something that might bother them, how they might react, I could anticipate a little bit how to present that information. And then at the checkout, it gives me a good sense of, like, people that may have not spoken too much in the meeting if I need to follow up with them. So it's an incredible piece of data that as a kind of the meeting organizer you get in order to kind of move your agenda forward.
My leader, actually, Tracy Reddish in the Department of Instructional Technology, starts every meeting with celebration and sharing, a way to just check in with everyone and see kind of, she gets, I think, a temperature of the room from that and how everyone is doing.
Yeah, and I think too, just honoring that people, you know, we're talking later in the show about learner voice, right? But oftentimes we skip over, you know, the leader, the teacher, the team. It's not just the learner, it's not just the student that needs to have a voice in situations. We don't just come to a meeting to sponge up whatever people are delivering it. It needs to be a little bit more collegial, a little bit more all in from everybody. So I just think that's a great tip for everyone.
A great way to start it off on a conversational footnote.
And I also, I mean, how long have we done tickets out the door as teachers, right? Where we sort of formatively assess, but we don't, I don't know why it should be, but it is so groundbreaking to think about doing that in a meeting with peers. So I just think that that's just really great. Another favorite tweetable that I have from the book, and this is one of the things that I think I highlighted as I passed my book to someone else to preview. It was highlighted, dog-eared, multiple times underlined, was this idea of, is it safe enough to try? And it's something that I've taken into my own practice and my own team and my own leadership style, literally from the moment that I opened the book. Just asking ourselves as we encounter something that maybe we have a little bit of cognitive dissonance with, maybe we're struggling a little bit with a decision to do something different from the way that we've always done it. If we just stop and ask, is this safe enough to try? What would it look like if the answer to that question was yes, if we just did it, if schools did it, if our teams did it? Anthony, can you share an example of maybe a success when this had happened, or maybe a school or a district where you think they are saying yes to that question, is this safe enough to try, and they're doing a great job at it?
Yeah, it's, well, first of all, it's a very tricky line. So instead of where people have been talking about, well, we have to fail forward, I think I like safe enough to try better because I never want to say, like, I'm anticipating failure. Even when I'm learning something, I don't necessarily try to anticipate my failures, but I know that I'm not going to get everything right each time. And that feels very different for me. So this is our version of kind of that mantra of failing forward. I think it's it's better in some ways, and it, we talk about it in the book, is often when someone comes to that meeting and proposes an idea, the other nine people in the meeting, they feel like it's their obligation to shut it down, right? So I come up with this idea, and it's like, everybody says, well, you didn't think about this and all this stuff. And they're not trying to be negative about it, but and they feel like they honestly feel like they're trying to be helpful. Mm-hmm. But they are giving you 10 reasons why we shouldn't do anything different than what we have, and making it upon you to go figure out and convince them why the organization should do it. And
are you there?
You cut out.
Do we still have you, Anthony?
Did we lose him? His phone might.
Uh-oh. You know, those cell networks in Frisco.
Anthony, we lost you if you can hear us.
Go back to the other room in your house.
I think.
Oh, there you are.
The first thing is, it just shifts the behavior of the person proposing an idea to defending it to all of the traditional naysayers defending why we shouldn't move forward with it. Because when you say, well, isn't it safe enough to try, it's up to the person that's naysaying it to show with some evidence that it's not safe enough, that it'll do harm to the organization. And it turns out there's very few things that necessarily could harm an organization. And so an example of this might be really even like something like any district trying to adopt a chapter in this book. Some people might say, well, you know, it's not proven. Where's the research behind this? Where's yada, 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 right? I mean, we hear all of that all the time. Absolutely. Give me an example of a similar district like ours with the exact same demographics of people.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Okay, right? Give us the Stanford research on this. I mean, we hear all of those things, and in fact, like, those things don't matter. There's practices that you could just start trying to learn and experience the change on your own. And you're not learning by hearing other people's story in their context and then thinking, like, you're going to implement it just the way they did.
Yeah, and right. That is such a crippling factor, I think, in so much of what I know your team at Ed Elements encounters, and certainly our team of iTeach coaches. You know, they want to see in their classroom with their students on a Friday after a field trip before a break,
yeah.
The most successful implementation. And with them as the skill set and the leader, right, as the teacher. So it's really hard even for us as coaches, where we do go in and sit in that space with those kids in those environments, because it's us, not them. And so all of that struggle is a lot of really easy, let me throw my hands up and just say I can't because it's not me and it's not my exact situation.
Yeah.
Where I think, you know, it's something certainly for my team that I'm encouraging people to just ask, is it safe enough to try? Are we going to, you know, it's sort of like the medical profession. Are we going to do no harm? If we can agree that we're going to do no harm, can we move it forward? I just think it's such a powerful question. And, you know, again, a lot of people cite Carol Dweck's work around growth mindset. And I don't think that this is in contention with that, but I think it's maybe a more mature version of that conversation rather than the idea of let's just fail a bunch of times, because nobody likes that feeling, right? Nobody
will. And that has fiscal consequences.
Yeah,
right.
Implications, sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, Anthony, this is Andy again. Hey, and as we start to wrap up on time here, I want to leave our listeners maybe with one final question. And we know that there's a lot of schools that are doing a lot of good out there and that there are things that are working. Can you share with our listeners some of the good things that you or your team come across that schools are doing? And if there's somebody out there listening who's looking for like a first step, what are some maybe some easy first steps that you've seen that your team has seen that work or that have worked?
Yeah, so I think there's an organizational system in the book around what I call atoms and molecules. So atoms are things that you could do on your own without requiring other people to be engaged. So, you know, a simple thing is, like, I could start every meeting with a check-in now. Like, everyone doesn't need to approve that, right, and be on the same page. I just run my meetings that way. But if I want to change the way roles are set up, right, which we talk about in the book, there needs to be a broader agreement, and so that's where, like, kind of the notion of molecules come in. So in some of the districts that we're working with, they are starting to test out this idea that not all projects are given to the person with the title in their job description, right? So there is some value in starting off new projects, restarting each project with a new team, just like the way I describe it is like a Hollywood model of building teams. And if you think about like some of the biggest movies out there that are hundreds of millions of dollars, they form teams right away and then they execute on the movie and then they go away and a new team gets started for the next movie. And it's never always the same people that are on these teams. And if you think about how incredible that is for the amount of complexity, whether you know, getting a producer, casting directors, stagehands, lighting directors, site, scenery people, like there's so many different moving parts to a movie, yet they're able to come together, execute really well, and then go away and then come back to another project. And I imagine that kind of the future of organizations looks something like that, where people can come together for projects regardless of what their kind of job titles are, get stuff done, and then move on to the next project. And it's not things just getting piled on top of you because you hold a particular title.
Yeah. This seems to make so much sense, doesn't it? As people have different expertise as well, as you, mm-hmm. you pull in different people with different experiences and different expertise to execute different projects. I mean, that to me makes a lot of sense.
That's like employee voice versus student voice, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing you have to remember is like, you know, not everybody has this equal amount of time every day, right? And so sometimes someone might have free time to work on something and also willingness. And we assume that, you know, just because you have a particular title that you deserve that kind of territory. And that's kind of like the feudal system, right? Just because I own this land, I own every decision in there.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's something that I think plagues a lot of organizations inside and outside of education, where your title defines your, you know, people say all the time, well, I'm going to stay in my lane. Well, why do you have a lane? Why are we not just all on the same?
Right. That's not in my job description.
Right.
Yeah.
And people, you know, make jokes all the time about other duties and responsibilities as assigned, right? Well, certainly for iTeach, we just don't have time for that, right? There's too much work to do and there's too great an influence of the collective of all of the people's experience that we have on the team. And I know the same is true for Ed Elements. When someone needs something accomplished, it is by no means one person's responsibility to do so. And I'm looking across the booth here at Andy, who's sort of the, you know, and David Lockhart's in the studio also, are two people that we have on the team that we call the jack of all trades. And sort of, you know, they're just like a living embodiment of a toolbox for when we have weird requests roll in or when we have projects come up, because their time is not dependent, as most of my team is, being one-on-one in the school. And so I think there's just some really interesting implications about not just the title that people hold, but also their time.
Right.
We talk a lot about that with teachers and how much time they have and how much they want more time to be able to do and explore other things that they might be passionate about or great at. So again, I think that's something that it just seems, again, like such a light bulb moment. Why haven't we been doing this? So that's the question I want to leave you with, Anthony. If you could kind of charge everyone to action, it seems crazy that it's taking, you know, the new school rules and this book and this conversation to spurn change in some of these organizations, and not change for change's sake, but to be better agile and more improved and more effective organizations. What's sort of the call to arms that you would issue to people who are exploring or wondering why they should plug into the book, why they should plug into this work?
You know, I think the quote that sticks out for me in the book is the Tom Northrop quote, which is, every organization is perfectly designed to get the results they're currently getting. And if you want different results, you have to do things differently. And I certainly believe that most educators that we work with and many educators across the country are wanting better results, not only in student outcomes, but they just want to have better day-to-day work experiences, which they're not getting. And I do believe that implementing these practices and becoming more agile and responsive to not only student needs through personalized learning, but also being responsive to things that are changing within your school, as well as yourself as individuals as we grow and evolve, it's going to reinvigorate the profession quite a bit.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, Anthony, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you for being our first go at a live call-in interview.
This is the first time on a live call.
First time.
Yeah, you are the first, which if anybody knows that that's perfect for you and your personality, that you would be the first to go to do something.
Yep.
And figure it out.
Safe enough to try,
that's,
I guess.
Right. We figured it was safe enough to try, especially with you, who we knew we weren't going to, have somebody scary on the phone. So we really appreciate you. And I just, again, I think that you're an awesome individual. You lead an awesome team. And we just so respect the work that you all are doing. Really love the book. You guys need to go check it out. Order it today. The New School Rules. It's got really great tips for everybody. Even teachers who say, this is above my pay grade. No, it's not. Your classroom is an organization. So you can absolutely, definitely use some of the same things that strategies and suggestions in the book that anybody else could use. So, Anthony, thank you so much. We appreciate you calling in. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony.
All right. Thanks, guys. Nice talking.
All right.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
iTeach Live is produced by the instructional technology coaches from iTeach at Kennesaw State University with the cooperation of the Instructional Technology Department, the Bagwell College of Education, and KSU Owl Radio. You can reach out to them for more information, questions, or comments at their website, iteach.kennesaw.edu, or on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at KSU iTeach.